This is chapter 4 of the Hunger Games. Once again, if you would like to follow along with a copy of the book or on Libby or Hoopla, you can do that. Chapter 4. A few moments, Peter and I take in the scene of our mentor trying to rise out of the slippery vile stuff from his stomach. The reek of vomit and raw spirits almost brings my dinner up. We exchange a glance. Obviously, Haymitch isn't much, but Effie Trinket is right about one thing. Once we're in the arena, he's all we got. As if some unspoken agreement, Peter and I each take one of Haymitch's arms and help him to his feet. I tripped? Haymitch asks. Smells bad. He wipes his hand on his nose, smearing his face with vomit. Let's get you back to your room, says Peanut, cleaning you up a bit. We half lead, half carry Haymitch back to his compartment. Since we can't exactly set him down in the embroidered bedspread, we haul him into the bathtub and turn the shower on for him. He hardly notices. It's okay, Peeta says to me. I'll take it from here. I can't help feeling a little grateful since the last thing I want to do is strip down Haymitch and wash the vomit out of his chest hair and tuck him into bed. Possibly Peeta is trying to make a good impression on him to be his favorite once the games begin. Judging by the state he's in, Haymitch will have no memory of this tomorrow. All right, I say. I can send one of the capital people to help you. There's any number on the train cooking for us, waiting on us, guarding us, taking care of us is their job. No, I don't want them, says Peeta. He nods his head to my own room. I understand how Peeta feels. He can't stand the sight of the capital people, myself. But making a deal with Haymitch might be a small form of revenge, so I'm pondering the reason he insisted taking care of Haymitch when all of a sudden I think it's because he's being kind. He just as he was kind to give me the bread. The idea pulls me up short. A kind Peeta Malark is far more dangerous than the one who's unkind to me. Kind people have a way of working their way inside me and rooting there. I can't let Peeta do this, not when we're going to... So I decide this moment we have a little possible to do with the baker's son. Get back to the room. The train is pausing at a platform to refuel. I quickly open the window and toss the cookies Peeta's father gave me. No more. No more of either of them. Unfortunately, the packet of cookies hits the ground and bursts into an open patch of dandelions by the track. I only see the image for a moment because the train is off again. But it's enough to remind me that the other dandelion in the schoolyard years ago. I just had turned away from Peeta's bruised face when I saw the dandelion, and I knew hope was lost. I just turned away, and I knew hope wasn't lost. Sorry. I plucked it carefully and hurried home. I grabbed a bucket from Prim's hand and headed to the meadow, and yes, it was dotted with golden-headed weeds. After we harvested those, we scrounged along the fence, probably a mile, until we filled the bucket with dandelion greens, stems, flowers, and that night we gorged ourselves in dandelion salad and the rest of the bakery bread. What else? Prim asked me. What other food can we find? All kinds of things, I promised her. I just have to remember them. My mother had a book that she brought from her wench from the apothecary shop. Those pages were made of old parchment covered in ink drawings of plants. Neat handwritten blocks told their names where to gather them. When they came into bloom in their medical uses, my father added other entries into the books. Plants for eating, not healing. Dandelion, pokeweeds, wild onions, pines. Prim and I spent the next day off school. For a while, I hung out around the edges of the meadow, but finally worked up the courage to go under the fence. It was the first time I'd been there alone, without my father's weapons to protect me. I retrieved a small bow and arrows he had made from a hollow tree. I probably didn't go more than 20 yards into the woods that day. Most of the time, I perched up on branches of an old oak, hoping for game to come by. After several hours, I had the good luck to kill a rabbit. I shot a few rabbits before with my father's guidance, but I'd done this all on my own. When we hadn't had the meat in months, the sight of the rabbit seemed to stir something up in my mother. She roused herself and skinned the carcass and made stew with the meat and some more greens Prim had gathered. Then she acted confused and went back to bed. When the stew was done, we made her eatable. The woods became our savior. Each day I went a bit farther into its arms. I was slow going at first, but I was determined to feed us. I stole eggs from nests, caught fish, and sometimes managed to shoot a squirrel or a rabbit for stew, and gathered various plants and sprung up beneath my feet. Plants are tricky. Many are edible, but one false mouthful and you're dead. I checked and double-checked plants I harvested with my father's pictures. I kept us alive. Any sign of danger, a distant howl, an inexplicable break of a branch, sent me flying back to the fence at first. I began to risk climbing trees to escape the wild dogs. That quickly got bored and moved on. Bears and cats live deeper, perhaps disliking the sooty reek of our district. On May 8th, I went to the Justice Building and signed up for my tessery and pulled home my first batch of grain and oil in Prim's toy wagon. On the 8th of every month, I was entitled to do the same. I couldn't stop hunting and gathering, of course. The grain was not enough to live on, but there's other things to buy, soap and milk and thread. We didn't have to absolutely eat, I began to trade at the hob, and they accepted me. Game was game after all, no matter who'd shot it. I also saw the back doors of wealthier clients in town, trying to remember what my father had told me about learning a few new tricks as well. The butcher would buy my rabbits, but not squirrels. The baker enjoyed squirrels, but would only trade one for one when his wife wasn't around. The head peacekeeper loved wild turkey, and the mayor had a passion for strawberries. In the late summer, I was washing up in a pond when I noticed the plants growing around me. Tall with leaves like arrowheads, blossoms, and three white petals. I noticed down in the water my fingers digging in the soft mud, and I pulled handfuls of roots, small bluish tubers that didn't look but boiled or baked were as good as any potato. Katniss, I said aloud. It's the plant I was named for. I heard my father's voice joking. As long as you can find yourself, you'll never starve. I spent hours stirring up the tubers and floated in the top. That night we feasted on fish and Katniss roots until we were all, for the first time in months, full. Slowly my mother returned to us. She began to clean and cook and preserve some of the food I brought in for the winter. People traded us or paid money in her medical remedies. One day I heard her singing. Prim was thrilled to have her back, but I kept watching, waiting for her to disappear on us again. I didn't trust her, and some small garland placed inside me hated her for her weakness, for her neglect. For months, she put us through. Prim forgave her, but I had taken a step back from my mother, put up a wall to protect myself from needing her, and nothing would ever be the same between us again. Now I was going to die without that being set right. I thought of how I yelled at her today in the Justice Building. I told her I loved her too, though, so maybe it wouldn't balance out. For a while, staring it through out the train window, wishing I could open it again, but unsure what would happen at such high speed in the distance. I see the lights of another district. 7? 10? I don't know, but I think people in the house are settling for bed. I imagine my home with the shutters drawn tight. What are they doing right now? Were they able to eat supper? The fish stew and strawberries? Or did it lie untouched on their plates? Did they watch the recap of the day's events on the battered old TV that sits on the table against the wall? Surely there were more tears in my mother holding Or is my mother holding up and being strong for Prim? Or has she already started to slip away, leaving the weight of the world on my sister's fragile shoulders? Prim will undoubtedly sleep with my mother tonight, with the thought of that scruffy old buttercup posting himself on the bed to watch over Prim comforts me. If she cries, he will nose his way down into her arms and curl up there until she calms down and falls asleep. I am so glad I didn't drown him. Imagining my home makes me ache with loneliness. This day has been endless. Could Gail and I have been eating blackberries only this morning? Seemed like a lifetime ago, like a long dream that had deteriorated into a nightmare. Maybe if I go to sleep, I will wake up back in District 12 where I belong. Probably the drawers hold any number of nightgowns, but I just strip off my shirt and pants and climb into bed in my underwear. The sheets are made of soft, silky fabric. A thick, fluffy comforter gives immediate warmth. If I'm going to cry now is the time to do it. By morning, I will be able to wash the damage done from my tears from my face, but no tears come. I'm too tired or too numb to cry. The only thing I feel is the desire to be somewhere else, so I let the train rock me into oblivion. Gray light is streaking through the curtains, and the rapping rouses me. I hear Effie Trinket's voice calling me to rise up. Up, up, up! It's going to be a big, big day! I try to imagine for a moment what it must be like inside that woman's head. What thoughts fill her waking hours? What dreams might come to her at night? I have no idea. I pull on the green outfit back on since it's not really dirty. I just slightly crumpled up by spending the night on the floor. My fingers trace through the circle around the little gold mockingjay. I think about the woods and my father, and how my mother and Prim are waking up, having to get on with things. I slept in the elaborate braided hair that my mother did for me for the reaping. It doesn't look too bad. I just leave it up. It doesn't matter. We can't be far from the capital now, and once we reach the city, my stylus will dictate my look for the opening ceremonies tonight anyway. I just hope I get one who doesn't think nudity is the last word in fashion. After eating in the dining car, Effie Trinket brushes by me with a cup of black coffee. She's muttering obediences under her breath, Haymitch in his face puffy and red from the previous night's indulgences. He's chuckling. Peter holds a roll and looks somewhat embarrassed. Sit down, says Haymitch, waving me over. The moment I slide in my chair, I am served an enormous platter of food. Eggs, ham, piles of fried potatoes, a tureen fruits, and sits in ice like to keep it chilled. A basket of rolls set before me. I keep my family going for a week. There's an elegant glass of orange juice. At least, I think it's orange juice. I've never tasted an orange once. New Year's, when my father brought... I've only ever tasted an orange once. At New Year's, when my father bought one as a special treat. A cup of coffee. My mother adores coffee, which we could almost never afford. But it only tastes bitter and thin to me. A rich brown cup of something that I've never seen. They call it hot chocolate, says Peeta. It's good. I take a sip of the hot, sweet, creamy liquid and a shudder runs through me. Even though the rest of the meal beckons, I ignore it until I've drained my cup. Then I stuff down every mouthful I can hurt in the substantial amount, being careful to not overdo the richest stuff. One time my mother told me I eat like I'll never see food again. I said I won't unless I bring it home. That shut her up. But when my stomach feels like it's about to split open, I lean back and take my breakfast companions. Peeta is still eating, breaking off bits of roll and dipping them into hot chocolate. Haymitch hasn't paid much attention to his platter, but he's knocking back a glass of red juice that keeps thinning and clear liquid from a bottle. Judging by the fumes, it's some kind of spirit. I don't know Haymitch, but I've seen him enough in the hob, tossing his handfuls of money in the counter to the woman who sells like white liquor. He'll be incoherent by the time we reach the capital. I realize I detest Haymitch. No wonder the District 12 tributes never stand a chance. This is why we've been This is why we've been underfed and a lack of training. Some of our tributes still have been strong enough to make a go of it, but we rarely get sponsors, and it's a big part of the reason the rich people who back tributes, either because they're betting on them or simply bragging rights for picking the winner, expect someone classier than Hamish to deal with them. "So, you're supposed to give us advice," I say to Hamish. "Here's some advice. Stay alive," says Hamish, and then bursts out laughing. I exchange a look with PETA. Before I remember, I'm having nothing more to do with him. I'm surprised to see the hardness in his eyes. He generally seems so mild. "That's very funny," says PETA, and then lashes out at the glass in Hamish's hand. It shatters to the floor, sending blood-red liquid running towards the back of the train. Only not to us. Hamish considers this for a moment and then punches PETA in the jaw, knocking him from his chair. When he turns back to reach for the spirits, I drive my knife through the table. Into the table between his hand and the bottle, barely missing his fingers. I brace myself to deflect his hit, and it doesn't come. Instead, he sits back and squints at us. "Well, what's this?" says Hamish. "Did I actually get a pair of fighters this year?" PETA rises from the floor and scoops up a handful of ice from under the fruit tree. He starts to raise the red mark on his jaw. "No," says Hamish, stopping him. "Let the bruise show. The audience will think you've mixed up with another tribute before you even made it to the arena. It's against the rules. Only if they catch you. The bruise will say you fought. You weren't caught, even better." He turns to me. "Can you hit anything with a knife besides a table?" The bow and arrow is my weapon, but I've spent a fair time about throwing knives as well. Sometimes I would wound an arrow with an arrow. It's better to get a knife into it, too, before I approach it. I realize that if I want Hamish's attention, it's my moment to make an impression. I yank the knife out from the table and get a grip on the blade, and then I throw it across the room. I was actually hoping to get a good solid stick, but it lodges between the seam and two panels, making me look a lot better than I am. "Stand over here, both of you," says Hamish, nodding towards the middle of the room. We obey, and he circles us, prodding us like animals at times, checking our muscles, examining our faces. "Well, you're not entirely hopeless. Seem fit. And once the stylists get a hold of you, you'll be attractive enough." PETA and I don't question this. The Hunger Games aren't a beauty contest. The best-looking tributes always seem to pull more sponsors. "All right, I'll make a deal with you. If you don't interfere with my drinking, and I'll stay sober enough to help you," says Hamish. "But you do exactly what I say." It's not much of a deal, but it's still a giant step forward from 10 minutes ago when we had no guide at all. "Fine," says PETA. "So help us," I say. "When we get to the arena, what's our best strategy at the cornucopia for someone? One thing at a time. In a few minutes, we'll be pulling into the station. You'll be put in the hands of your stylist, and you're not going to like what they do to you. But no matter what you do, no matter what it is, don't resist." But I begin, "No buts, don't resist," says Hamish. He takes a bottle of spirits from the table and leaves the car. This door swings shut, and the car goes dark. There are still a few lights inside, but outside, it's as if the night's fallen again. I realize we must be in the tunnel that runs up through the mountains into the capital. The mountains are a natural barrier from the capital and the eastern districts. It's almost impossible to enter except through the tunnels. This geographical advantage was the major factor. The districts are losing what they led to me being a tribute today. Losing the war that led to me being in tribute today. Since the rebels had to scale the mountains, they were easy targets for the capital's air forces. PETA, Malark, and I stand in silence as the train speeds along. The tunnels go on, and I think of tons of rocks separating from the sky, and my chest tightens. I hate being encased in stone this way. It reminds me of the mines and my father trapped, unable to reach sunlight, buried forever in the darkness. The train finally begins to slow, and suddenly, bright light floods the compartment. We can't help it. Both PETA and I run to the window and see what we've only seen on television, the capital, the ruling city of Panem. The cameras haven't lied about its grandeur. If anything, they have not quite captured the magnificence of the glistening buildings of rainbow of hues in towers and into the air, the shiny cars that roll down the window and pave streets, the oddly dressed people with the bizarre hair and painted faces who've never missed a meal, and the colors seem artificial, the pinks too deep and the greens too bright, the yellows painful to the eyes, like flat round discs of hard candy that we never able to afford to buy at the tiny sweet shop in District 12. The people began to point eagerly as they recognized the tribute train rolling into the station. I step away from the window, sickened by their excitement, knowing that they can't wait to watch us die. But PETA holds his ground, actually waving and smiling at the gawking crowd. Only stops when the train pulls into the station, blocking us from their view. He sees me staring at him and shrugs. Who knows? He says, one of them might be rich. I have misjudged him. I think of his actions since the reaping, the friendly squeeze in my hand, his father showing up with cookies and promised to feed Prim. Did PETA put him up to that? His tears at the station, volunteering to wash Haymitz, but then challenging him this morning when apparently the nice guy approach had failed, and now waving at the window, already trying to win the crowd. All the pieces are still fitting together, but the sense he had planned for me, he hadn't accepted his death. He was already fighting hard to stay alive, which means that the kind PETA Malark, the boy who gave me the bread, is fighting hard to kill me.